Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Boston officials report a surge in opioid overdose deaths.
And I think the unpredictability and the instability of the illicit drug supply right now is a huge component. At least that's what I hear from patients.
Also today, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh's plan to rebuild the bridge to Long Island for addiction treatment.
I pledge to you today that we are and we will rebuild the bridge back to Long Island.
Plus, the challenges of navigating winter sidewalks when you have a physical disability and how a doctor and patient beat cancer by using participatory medicine.
I had kidney cancer growing out of my tongue, and what I read was that my median survival was 24 weeks. This was bad.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. New data show the opioid epidemic is getting worse in Boston. The Boston Public Health Commission says there was a 54% increase in overdose deaths in Boston last year compared to the previous year. The numbers are collected by Boston Emergency Medical Services, and they represent a portion of all deaths tracked in the city. And this increase comes despite the latest state-level data, which was released last year, that showed a decrease in the number of overdose deaths across the state. So something is going on in Boston. And WBUR's Martha Biebinger has been following this, and she joins us to explain. Hi there, Martha.
Hi, Deb.
So what are the numbers?
The numbers are from Boston EMS, as you said, and they show several things. They show a 20% increase in heroin cited. So that's when an EMS worker would show up and find a needle or a tourniquet or something on the scene. They show a 30% increase in the use of Narcan, the drug used to reverse an opioid overdose. And they show, as you said, a 54% increase in cases reported to the medical examiner. Those are deaths.
So do we know why these numbers are so high? Why these are all double-digit increases?
Yeah, we don't. I mean, it could be more people becoming addicted. It could be more potent forms of fentanyl, that synthetic opioid that's getting mixed into bags of drugs and pills and everything that people are taking. It could be that fewer Latinos are calling 911 or reaching out to any authority for fear of deportation. We're hearing that on the streets, too. But we're hearing from doctors that something is really scary. So they're using multiple times more of that drug Narcan or the generic name Naloxone to bring people back. I spoke to Dr. Sarah Wakeman, who's the medical director of the Mass General Hospital Substance Use Disorder Initiative, who said she's really not surprised by these numbers.
I think the most I've heard was from colleagues who use something like 14 doses of naloxone. And we're definitely hearing from people who, you know, in the past maybe would have used one or two doses and now are using 5, 6, 7, 8.
So that would suggest stronger drugs, obviously.
It would. Yes, definitely.
Now, we mentioned the state has been touting data that indicates a 10% drop in overdose deaths in the first three quarters of 2017 compared to previous years. So why do you think we might be seeing this discrepancy in Boston? What are some of the theories?
Well, nobody seems to know. I mean, the Boston EMS data is not kept or collected the same way that the state data is. So you can't you can't compare them exactly. What we have to think about more is the kind of the clinical information we're hearing from people about the rates of overdose that they're having to reverse and how hard it is to reverse them. It's possible that the state data, Deb, which went through September, did not take into account what appears to have been a spike in Boston in the late summer, early fall. The Boston Public Health Commission put out an advisory in the middle of September that said we're seeing a 50% increase in overdoses just in the last month or so. And it's not clear that the state had all of that when they were making their projections about what was going on.
Now, this is new data, but so far today, what have you heard from folks in Boston about these numbers?
Well, what I hear from people is some discouragement, you know. They certainly had hoped that the state data showing a decrease was accurate. And I guess statewide, it's certainly possible that it is. It is accurate. But there is real fear that we are seeing some of these more potent fentanyl analogs that are just very difficult to reverse in the field. I mean, nobody is going to carry around 5, 6, 7, 8 kits of naloxone and reverse the person that they're using drugs with that. So I think there's a lot of fear and also some definitely resilience. You know, like okay, we have to step up efforts now. We have to be even more vigilant about getting people into treatment, about finding new drugs that will help both reverse overdoses, about prevention, about everything.
And emergency officials must walk that line between sort of feeling resilience and maybe a little bit of hope to sometimes feeling discouraged.
Oh, and burnout.
Right.
Absolutely.
To put it kindly, sometimes feeling discouraged. Yeah.
Okay. No, there's some. I think this will rock things a bit. Yeah.
All right. WBUR's Martha Biebinger on the latest numbers of opioid overdose deaths in Boston. Martha, thanks so much.
Thank you, Deb.
And we want to take some time now to look at Boston's plan for an addiction recovery campus on Long Island in Boston Harbor. Mayor Marty Walsh made a somewhat surprising announcement about this during his inaugural address last week.
I pledge to you today that we are and we will rebuild the bridge back to Long Island. And we will create on Long Island the comprehensive long-term recovery campus that our city and our state needs now more than ever to tackle the opioid crisis.
The mayor says rebuilding the bridge could cost between $40 and $100 million. The original bridge to the island was abruptly shut down 3 years ago because it was not safe. The closure forced the shutdown of hundreds of beds for the homeless and for substance use treatment. And some in Quincy, where the bridge was located, are saying to Mayor Walsh, not so fast. They're concerned about traffic, and they say they want to be part of any talks about future bridge development. We spoke with Quincy Mayor Tom Coker earlier today, and we asked him why he does not support the plan to rebuild the bridge to Long Island.
Well, first of all, I think very highly of Mayor Walsh. I consider him, obviously, he's a colleague and a friend, and I admire his role in the world of trying to make a difference in addiction. So we've had a lot of discussions over the years on those issues. So we're on the same page with our commitment to addiction, and certainly I have no problem with Long Island being used for some of those programs.
But
my issue is access. And, you know, when I look right now at what we're doing statewide, and the governor has a commission going for a new Boston Harbor water transportation system, which Secretary Pollack, the transportation secretary, has been working on. I know certainly I've been engaged. I'm sure Tom McGee, Mayor of Lynn's, been engaged, and others, where we have cities all across the world that take full advantage of water transportation, and we are waterfront communities, and we don't do that very well, and we're going in that direction now. And I think this would be the perfect time to look at a beautiful new terminal for ferry service right out of Long Island. In fact, that could become the hub for the whole service for the entire harbor. So I think it's time we looked at that seriously, and I think that if there's – listen, I have no control, nor should I have an opinion on how Boston spends their money. However, if the state and federal money involved, I would certainly advocate the state and federal government look at a ferry system that would be far less expensive than the bridge. And I do believe that in my years of public service and my involvement in construction, that the numbers that have been thrown out there are very, very low for a bridge. My guess.
So the 40 to 100 million is too low?
That's correct. I would bet you somewhere between 150 and 200 million. And I've had conversations with a lot of engineers. The four river bridge was just done for 240 million. Now that has a lift component, but if we're looking at a bridge, probably if you actually get through the permitting, it's probably 4 or 5 years out. So when you talk about inflation, my guess is you're in that range. I think you could do an awful lot for water transportation for less than half of that money, probably a third.
Well, you know, some folks say it's a ferry service would be much more expensive. Folks at Camp Harbor View, which is out on Long Island now, they say it costs about $500,000 to bring 900 campers and staffers out there for the summer. They also say because this is a medical facility, insurance may not reimburse because there needs to be 24/7 emergency access to the island. So there are some differences here because you're talking about a medical treatment facility, but not necessarily a hospital and all kinds of other things. What do you say to those folks who say, no, actually, ferry service is much more than a bridge would be?
Let's sit down and have that discussion. Let's truly vet the facts on this, what the real numbers are, and let's have that discussion. The reality is if you've got that many beds in a facility out there, you're going to have clinicians, perhaps doctors and nurses, on the island anyway. If there's an emergency, so they're calling for an ambulance coming from Boston, you're coming from Boston, over the Neponset River, down Quincy Shore Drive, out East Squantum Street, the causeway, to Moon Island, to the causeway, to Long Island over the bridge, to some building on Long Island. My guess is, if there was that state of emergency, a ferry would be quicker, or, you know, we have medical hospital helicopters that certainly are used in the region if you had a real emergency. So I think all of those things should be on the table and discussed and properly vetted before people take these positions based on numbers that haven't been proven to me in any factual way.
Hmm. Now, Mayor Walsh, in a Boston Globe editorial this week, 1 week after he announced his plan, wrote that he was disappointed by the negative response, and he seemed to kind of be talking about you a little bit, and he said he was also disappointed by what he called this not-in-my-backyard paranoia. What do you say to folks who accuse you of NIMBYism?
Well, I don't think they know me, and I don't think they know Quincy. I'm not going to take a backseat to anybody in how our community has embraced the addiction fight and challenge. I'm not going to put up with that from anybody. To me, the issue here is transportation/access. That is the issue.
Mm-hmm. Essentially, what you're saying is that it might be cheaper to do this with ferry service as opposed to a bridge. That's the main thing.
I believe it could be much cheaper, number one. Number two is the bridge is built, and the mayor left his, I know in the story, that the column that Joan Vernocchi wrote, he left it open that there could be further development out there. That concerns me for far more traffic going through this narrow route to get to the island. So that concerns me. If we're going to have the discussion, then let's put all our cards on the table.
So traffic is another main issue. What's traffic like in that neighborhood now?
Again, you're coming through a very narrow stretch. You go from Squantum Street, narrows down to Dorchester Street, and then takes a hairpin turn to get up to where the entrance to Moon Island is. And there's homes all along there, right on the back of sidewalk, very tight. So traffic is a major, major issue. And if the development continues on Long Island, that's only going to add to that traffic burden, which creates more of a problem for not only that neighborhood, but certainly other people traveling the roads of North Quincy into Boston. So it's a combination of issues, but all relating to access.
So traffic is an issue, not just if this becomes a recovery campus, as the mayor has suggested, but also you are concerned about this possibility that's been floated of perhaps more development on Long Island than just a recovery campus, because it is prime waterfront real estate right near the city.
Beautiful location, 250 acres. And I don't want to put words in his mouth because he's never discussed with me anything about development out there, but he left that door open in his comment in the Vernocchi column in the Globe, and so that concerns me.
Now, you say you want Quincy to have a seat at the table. What do you mean exactly? What are you looking for?
We're the access point. No matter how you slice this thing, Long Island access comes through Quincy. So, you know, and the mayor did indicate that, you know, he'd have further discussions with me, slash the city, about the process going forward.
That was Quincy Mayor Tom Koch, who we spoke with earlier today. Listeners, we want to hear from you. Should Boston rebuild the bridge to Long Island? Should there be an addiction recovery campus on the island? Should Quincy have a say? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. We want to say that we did reach out to Mayor Walsh, but he was not available today with us. Instead, from the city of Boston is Chris Odgood. He's the chief of streets, transportation, and sanitation. Thanks for being with us, Chris.
Deborah, it's my pleasure.
So tell us about this plan to rebuild the bridge to Long Island.
Sure. So the mayor is very committed to strengthening the continuum of care for those who are battling with addiction, and part of that is building a comprehensive long-term recovery campus on the island. And core to that plan is rebuilding Long Island Bridge to ensure that we've got a reliable connection to the services that are going to be on the island.
Mm-hmm. So how big of a bridge? Would it be just like the old one? How many lanes? What are we talking? Do we know yet?
So it will be very similar to the old one. The entire span is about 3,400 feet long. The original bridge, as you may know, was built in 1951. As you pointed out, it was closed in 2014. What we'd be looking to do is build a bridge that is, again, very similar to that original bridge, similar in size, in scale, in programming. That would mean there'd be a lane in each direction on the bridge, sidewalks on both sides, and passage for boats beneath.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you just heard our conversation with Quincy Mayor Tom Koch, who says a couple of things. First of all, he thinks that the $40 to $100 million estimate that's been discussed about this bridge is a little low. He thinks it might be more like $150 to $200 million for this bridge. What are you thinking this bridge is going to cost?
Sure. We're actually quite confident in our estimate for the cost of the bridge. There's a number of reasons for that. First of all, it won't be a movable bridge. Movable bridges do cost more than those that are fixed. Also, the piers actually exist. There's 12 piers from the original bridge, which are still in the water that would be able to leverage for the new bridge. And a lot of the utilities that would go on typical bridges have actually already been addressed as part of previous investment efforts. So we believe that that range is correct, and we would estimate that right now the cost of the bridge would be around $80
million. $80 million. Where would the funding come from?
So a principal source of the funding will be something which is called the Parking Meter Fund. This is revenue, which, as the name indicates, quite literally comes from parking meters in the city of Boston.
That's why I always get a ticket, Chris.
So that money basically is dedicated to go to transportation-related investments and programs. So everything from bus lanes or bike lanes or better sidewalks to things like bridges. So right now we're looking at allocating around $30 million from the Parking Meter Fund for this project. And over the course of this year and next, we've building out what a funding plan would look like for the bridge as a whole.
Mm-hmm. And what about Mayor Koch's suggestion that ferry service be looked at instead, and that might be a more less expensive way of doing this?
Sure. So I certainly appreciate that point. The reason that we're looking at a bridge is simply because a bridge is the most reliable connection to these core services. What is going on the island, again, is sort of a comprehensive long-term recovery campus. That's going to mean treatment beds and transitional supports. And these are really critical services for people in the city of Boston and across the region that need to be relied on every day of the year, no matter what the weather is. The most effective and reliable way we can get people to and from these core services every single day is with a bridge. And that means getting staff there, getting clients there, getting supplies there, and also means responding to medical emergencies if they are to occur.
Is it accurate that some insurers might not cover treatment that's going on out there if there is not reliable emergency access?
So the medical sort of insurance question may be better for Jen Tracy, who mm-hmm. you'll speak to in a moment. But it is very clear for us that these are services which are going to be depended on by lots of people, and that we want to make sure that we've got a reliable connection. And just as a relevant note, the Hingham Ferry, which is a fantastic commuter service within our harbor, has been out of commission for a number of days this year as a result of this weather. And of course, we've had some pretty extreme weather over the last couple of weeks. But we want to make sure that no matter the weather, that people can always get to the campus that we're creating at Long Island.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering also, Norfolk County GA Michael Morrissey and Quincy Mayor Koch say that there really is a longer range plan here to use Long Island for other development aside from an addiction recovery campus. Are there other development plans, or is that an option that's on the table?
So the mayor's focus is really on building this comprehensive recovery campus here on the island, and that's really why we're building the bridge. The bridge is to serve the island, and that's entirely our focus right now.
Mm-hmm. I asked Mayor Walsh about the bridge to Long Island back in October when I was doing a story about the mayoral race and Mayor Walsh's efforts in the opioid epidemic, and the office emailed a statement to me saying, quote, "We need to see and address the problem. Opening the bridge back up does nothing to solve the addiction problem, though. We need the funding to be able to open programs out there." So do you know, have any idea, Chris, what might have changed in 3 months?
Sure. So I think over the course of the last several years, obviously there's been a tremendous amount of investment by the city and by a whole host of partners, and you'll hear more from Jen for, on this in a bit, in restoring recovery beds within the city through in partnership with many, many other organizations, improving our outreach services and opening an Office of Recovery Services. We are now at a point where we believe we've got the funding, which will allow us to rebuild the bridge and reinvest in the campus that's already there so that we can open up that as the next part of our continuum of care.
All right. Chris Osgood, Chief of Streets, Transportation, and Sanitation for the City of Boston. Thanks so much. I understand Jen is with you right now.
She is. I will get her on the line.
All right. So joining us to talk about further about this is Jen Tracy. She's Director of the Office of Recovery Services for the City of Boston. Jen, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Deb.
Hey, can you tell us just briefly how many beds and what exactly is a long-term recovery campus that might be on Long Island to build the bridge to?
So, thanks. We're really excited about this opportunity, and we think it's once in a lifetime. So, as far as the amount of beds, that's going to be forthcoming. We're pulling together partners, city, state, private partners, and really to get the details of the actual services, how many beds, and what the continuum of care will look like.
Mm-hmm. And so basically, though, what you're thinking of is a long-term continuum of care that would include from folks right at the beginning entering detox all the way through till they're doing just sort of supportive housing, correct?
Well, that's the basic continuum of care as we know it. But again, we're going to be looking at all that. So there are services that we have built and that have changed in the last 4 years since the bridge went down. We're going to be, the epidemic has played a major role in changing the picture of what types of services we know that we need now. Maybe that was different than 4 years ago. So we're really going to work with our partners in multiple sectors to think what is the most innovative, state-of-the-art continuum of care with this piece of land, which you know, we wouldn't be able to access in any other way in Boston, and how are we going to look forward with this epidemic and addiction and support people in their recovery?
So at this point, it's,
I hope more than that.
Okay, so at this point, it's still being drawn up. Would you say?
Correct.
Okay. There was talk about locating a recovery campus on the Shattuck Hospital site. What became of that idea, and why was there a switch to Long Island? I don't know if you've heard me ask Chris, but I had been speaking with Mayor Walsh about opioids when I was doing a story about the mayoral election, and he said at that point back in October, opening the bridge back up, quote, does nothing to solve the addiction problem. We need the funding to be able to open programs out there. What's changed since then, Jen?
Well, I think the mayor's commitment, the mayor doesn't make this type of commitment easily. He, as you know, has made recovery a big commitment of his administration and has taken, you know, the time to think about his moves in that first opening the Office of Recovery Services, as you know, to really be the first office in the country to be, you know, a mayor's level office to look at the continuum of care, the access to care issues, what people in the city of Boston and beyond, quite frankly, need. And so I think the mayor's commitment, if people know him, is one of the, you know, biggest signals to us as to what's different now. Well, of course, we'll need to meet with all of our state and local and private partners to start to map out what are the services, what's covered by insurance, what's not, what kind of role do private and public organizations want to play in helping us map out this really state-of-the-art, exciting opportunity to respond to the opioid epidemic.
Now, some have suggested that putting this out on Long Island is hiding the addiction problem by not giving people more of an opportunity to integrate while they're in recovery, or and sort of isolating people on an island where they're not as visible. What do you say to folks who, you know, these have been printed and tweeted and everything else? I'm sure you're aware of these concerns. What would you say to folks?
Well, again, you know, I'm going to say, you know, we in Boston, we know recovery. And, you know, with Mayor Walsh as a leader, we know the type of opportunity that Long Island gives us to provide an oasis for folks to stabilize and to get their feet back on the ground. And we actually look at this as an opportunity that's going to be helpful And that's going to provide people with stability that sometimes in and around the city that they don't find in the same way. So what works for different people, sometimes folks like to get away from their community. Some people are going to choose to, you know, a nice continuum of care in one place in a serene and tranquil setting to experience their recovery.
Okay. Jen Tracy, Director of the Office of Recovery Services for Boston, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And I also want to have weigh in on this, someone who is actually operating a program out on Long Island. It's Camp Harbor View, a summer camp for Boston's underserved neighborhoods. Every summer, the camp brings about 900 campers and staff to the island. And on the line from Florida is Jack Connors. He's chair and co-founder of Camp Harbor View. He also serves on the boards of Boston College and the Red Sox Foundation and is a founding partner of the marketing and communications company Hill Holiday. Hi there, Jack.
How are you, Deborah?
So describe the island just very briefly. A lot of people may not realize how big it is.
So it's plus or minus 240 acres.
Mm-hmm.
It's got an amazing history. It was a Civil War training facility for the Union Army. Mm-hmm. It was a tuberculosis hospital nearly a century ago when folks needed to be quarantined.
So we can't get into the history too much because we don't have a lot of time. You ferry about 900 campers plus staff every summer. How much does that cost and how does that work? And do you think ferrying folks to a large recovery campus on the island would be feasible?
So we have, trying to answer your question in order, we have 900 campers, 90 staff. We put 450 kids there in July, another 450 in August with 90 staff in July and in August. We're about to enter year 12. And in terms of having folks in recovery there, actually, if you go back to our beginning, there were already folks in recovery there. So it's nothing new for us to be neighbors with folks that are recovering.
Mm-hmm. And so do you think, though, that this has been talked about, Jack, that this is actually rebuilding the bridge is actually part of a plan for future development on Long Island, not just a recovery center? And how might that affect your camp?
Well, we have a long-term lease, Deborah, so I'm not really worried about future development. I think it probably makes a lot of sense for the mayor to consider development opportunities over time. But our focus is on providing a great, safe, and enjoyable experience for the kids in the summer, and it's been well received. It costs us about $5 million a year, $5.5 million a year to run the camp, and we've been able to raise that and more each year to the point where we now have an endowment for these kids. So we've got a successful mission on our hands, thanks to the leadership of all the people that are involved in it, led by Sharon McNally, who's our president. And we're feeling pretty good about it. I think that what the mayor is talking about is kind of interesting because I'm also on the board of something called RISE, which is trying to deal with this opioid epidemic. And yesterday we lost 6 people in Massachusetts. Today we'll lose 6 to death from opioid addiction, and tomorrow we'll lose another 6. So I find it kind of interesting that someone's thinking about how to deal with this emergency and recognizing that people don't want to deal with it in their own backyard. So I think this makes a great deal of sense.
Okay, Jack, stay on the line with us a minute because we have a lot of callers who want to weigh in here and talk about their thoughts about this plan. So please stay with us. First, I want to read a response that we got on Twitter. Ed Lyons says, I think this bridge to Long Island is a great idea. A bridge may make all kinds of future projects possible. And also we have Jessica on the line with us who's calling from Mattapan. Jessica, you're on the air. Jessica, are you with us? No, I think we may have lost Jessica. John is calling from Marshfield. John, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Hi.
Good, Jack, thank you for all your good work over the years. Listen, Mayor Quincy was being completely disingenuous when talking about the cost for a bridge. The Four River Bridge is a four-lane state highway vertical lift bridge. He's just trying to distract because he wants to appease his constituents in Squanton. who just want to go back to being a nice seaside neighborhood, but it really hasn't been a nice seaside. It was a nice seaside neighborhood, even when the bridge was there. Quincy politics is a clown show.
Well, aside from Quincy politics, though, do you think that this bridge should be rebuilt and a recovery campus should be put on there?
The city of Quincy, first of all, the city of Boston owns Long Island, and for another municipality to be dictating how the city of Boston should run their own property smacks of paternalism. Well, I can't say paternalism, but a weird sort of NIMBYism. Listen, Quincy has enough problems on their own that they shouldn't have to worry about a bridge that's been in place, that was in place from the 1950s to 2012. All you're doing is putting that in the bridge. And also, please remember, the infrastructure for these facilities is already out in Long Island. This is not going to be like ground-up construction. You're doing a bridge plus a new hospital. You probably have to renovate, but you're reusing the facilities that are there.
Okay, John, thanks so much for your call. I want to get to more callers here. Jessica is calling from Mattapan. Jessica, you're on the air. You're back with us. You're on the air. You know, it's my understanding you actually worked on Long Island before the bridge was closed.
I did, yes.
And so let's talk about that infrastructure. Is it okay out there?
There were some buildings that had areas that we didn't utilize, but as a whole, I feel like it was the perfect place for people to recover. You could get all services out there, and it was a great sense of community. And right after the bridge was closed, that's when you saw the area that they referred to as Methadone Mile and all of that get so bad on Mass Ave. And so many people relapsed and lost this sense of home, basically. Like, some people would get out and go to Wyman Reentry and learn how to transition back into society from jail. And if they messed up, they might end up at the shelter. And then if they wanted to get help, they could go over to Andrew's house and go to detox and then go on to their TSS program. I actually still currently work for a TSS program that was originally located on the island, and we're now located in Mattapan.
Mm-hmm. And so you think it should be reopened? Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Hello? It's very disheartening even for clients. I actually just had a discussion with clients the other day that was saying that they really hope that the development doesn't go to something else and that it remains a recovery campus. And it's really disheartening to hear that that it's even being thought of being used for anything other than what it was used for. It was the perfect place.
But could there be room? But Jessica, could there be room for further development, particularly if it could fund a bridge and some other things out there? If you've got 250 acres, sounds like quite a bit of space to me.
What else would they want to build, and how would, if it's going to be businesses or if it's going to be some type of waterfront, like resort or anything like that, how are they going to feel about having addiction services all over the island? Much of the island was being utilized. All of the buildings were being utilized. There was an area where they had a farm that was beautiful. The people from the shelter would work on the farm, and then employees could partake in a farm share, which also brought more revenue onto the island for the programs.
Okay, well, it looks like it's moving forward. Jessica, thanks so much for your call. Briefly, Jack Connors, last word. Quincy wants to be at the table to talk about rebuilding this bridge. Will Camp Harborview be at the table, maybe?
Well, I'm in the business of helping all these kids in the city. So my guess is we'll leave that up to other people to decide whether we belong at the table, but I'm hopeful that we will. One comment I'd like to make briefly, Deborah, is that the island finds itself in a very shallow area. So if people want to build ferry terminals there, we're going to have millions and millions of dollars worth of dredging to do to get any kind of good-sized ferries in there. So I think that this is an interesting model. It's a city asset, and we ought to take advantage of it. I'll let everybody else be the judge of how to do so, but we're really proud of what we have out there, and we're very grateful for the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners.
Okay, well, we're glad that you were able to talk with us. Jack Connors, chairman of Camp Harborview, founding partner of the marketing and communications company Hill Holiday. Thanks for being with us.
Have a great day, everyone.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
You too. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Former State Senate President Stan Rosenberg says he has separated from his husband, Brian Hefner. That comes amid allegations that Hefner sexually harassed men and claimed to have influence over state Senate business. For more on this, we're joined now by WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown. Steve, thanks for making the time to talk with us.
That's quite all right, Deb.
So you and some other reporters caught up with Rosenberg today, his first day back at the State House since he left the Senate presidency. Let's hear a little bit of the tape that you have about what he told you.
Can you confirm that you've separated from Brian?
I have.
Can you tell us about what was behind that decision?
That's personal, and he is getting the treatment for alcohol that he needs, and that's about all that can be said about that.
That's State Senator Stan Rosenberg. Steve Brown, did Rosenberg say much beyond that or no?
Not regarding Brian Hefner, but he did say that he has not spoken to his fellow senators about a potential return as Senate president. He said the senators have been counseled that they should minimize contact with him so that no one can say that there was any influence over the investigation.
Hmm. So remind us just briefly about the investigation that the Senate has undertaken, and because of allegations against Hefner. And again, Rosenberg here has not been accused of any wrongdoing, correct?
That's right. The investigation is looking into these allegations against Hefner, although the Senate can't do anything about those. What they're looking at is, did any of those allegations of sexual misconduct on the part of Brian Hefner influence the Senate at all? And that's kind of at the heart of the matter, is that Hefner allegedly indicated that he did have influence over the Senate and that he could influence Stan Rosenberg. So that's what that investigation is looking into, to find out if anything was done in the Senate because of what Brian Hefner did.
Now, the Boston Globe is reporting that allies of Rosenberg see a path for him to potentially return to the Senate presidency. And as you mentioned, Rosenberg also said that he's not in much contact with his colleagues. I mean, what should we make of this, Steve? Does it look as if Rosenberg is trying to go back to his post as Senate president?
I believe he would like to be able to do that. And I think there is a path that he could get back. You have to remember, Stan Rosenberg is very well liked by his Senate colleagues, both professionally and personally. He has actually taken the step, I think the key step, of separating from Brian Hefner, that he can now go to those senators and say, I've separated from him. He will not be an issue anymore. Let me come back. And he may make that pitch sometime in the near future.
Okay, WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown joining us live from Beacon Hill. Steve, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Deb.
A week ago, a snowstorm dumped some 13 inches of snow on Boston, and then much of it froze over, which made clearing streets and sidewalks a real challenge, one that is even more difficult for those with physical disabilities. Amy Corcoran-Hunt knows this all too well. She's lived in the South End for 19 years, and she's been in a wheelchair for 5. She said she's had real difficulty getting around after this storm, and so we invited her on the show to talk about it. Amy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for shining a light on this.
So can you tell us how you get around when there's no snow?
I get around fairly regularly and easily without the snow. We have great curb cuts on all the sidewalks brought to you by the Americans with Disabilities Act, and it's generally not a problem.
So what happened?
I live a life like everybody else.
Yeah, so what happened after the snowstorm then? Like, I can understand the snow would make it difficult, but is this storm also different than others? I mean, tell me what it's been like.
No, it's not. It's basically every snowstorm. The issue is that, you know, we have the ramps at all of our intersections, which is terrific, and it means I can get around. And then when it snows, the city plows the snow on top of the ramps. They plow the snow on top of the curb cuts and all the crosswalks. And then apparently, according to the rules, residents are responsible for clearing a path for me, which I find kind of crazy. They'd need their own plows. They make these big giant piles of snow, and then people are just supposed to attack it with shovels, I guess.
Hmm. So have you spoken with the city or any officials about this? I know some City of Boston spokesperson says since last week's storm, they've received some 65 service requests for unshoveled handicap ramps.
Yeah. As I understand it, the Disability Commission, the phone's been ringing off the hook. But we just need a brand new system. You know, it's nobody's fault. I don't know. You know, it's not necessarily something that people think about, but we need a new system. We can't have a system where the city plows make big piles and then they assume that people are just going to move those big piles.
Right. And you've had to reach out to some of your neighbors for help, right?
Yeah, and I went out today. I made it two blocks before I ran into a big pile of snow that was covering a curb cut. I had to turn around and I couldn't get where I was going. I was out a couple of days ago, same thing. I made it about three blocks a couple of days ago. So, you know, people are great. People shovel their sidewalks, but I don't think the average Boston resident knows that they're responsible for attacking giant piles of snow and, you know, clearing the handicap ramp. Hmm. But apparently that's the rule.
But when you did contact the city, what did you say? What did they tell you?
All you do is do the 311 thing. I do it online. They note the case, and who knows what they're going to do.
Okay. Well, Amy, I hope we can stay clear from some snow at least for the next couple of days.
That would be great. Yeah. And you know, I'm not throwing shade at anybody. It's not the plow guys. They're working hard when most of us are asleep. I voted for the mayor and I'll vote for him again. We just need a new system.
All right. Well, Amy Corcoran Hunt, a South Boston resident who uses a motorized wheelchair to get around. She joined us from her home. Amy, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. Coming up, a doctor and patient join us to talk about participatory medicine and how patients can become more involved in their medical care. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. What would happen if patients were equal partners in the medical system? And that's exactly what our next guests say they're working to find out. Dr. Danny Sands and Dave DeBronkart are co-founders of the Society for Participatory Medicine. They're also co-authors of the book Let Patients Help, a Patient Engagement Handbook. Dave was diagnosed with stage 4 renal cell carcinoma in 2007, but he was able to beat the disease, and he credits his recovery in large part to not only the care he received from Dr. Sands, but also to Sands' suggestion that he turn to an online community for support. As part of WBUR's year-long series, This Moment in Cancer, Dave and Danny are with us in studio to tell us about participatory medicine. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be here.
So, Dave, let's start with you. Can you tell us about your diagnosis first?
It was out of the blue. I got a shoulder x-ray for a stiff shoulder. I had no idea I was sick. And the next day, Dr. Sands called and said, there's something in your lung. Totally by coincidence, there was a shadow in the lung near the shoulder. It turned out that was one of ultimately about a dozen metastases all through my body. Kidney cancer is a slow-moving killer. The best available data said that my median survival was 24 weeks.
24 weeks. Yeah. And so then what did you tell him, Danny?
Well, we had a long talk about, you know, how Dave. So one of the reasons that we were together is that Dave is interested in technology and healthcare. I've been interested in technology and in healthcare for decades. And one of the things I told Dave, besides to seek out an online patient community, was that there's a lot of information available online and that I wanted to share everything that's going on with his care with him at every stage so that he could follow along and be a better partner in his care.
Mm-hmm. And so how did this online community help you?
Well, you know, it's fascinating because, you know, a lot of people think that I turned to the internet on my own and found a treatment. My TED Talk website actually has that wrong. The reality is, first thing we did was connect with the oncologists, but then Dr. Sands said, you might like to join this community. And Within 2 hours of posting my first note there, I got all kinds of messages back from other people saying, we know how you feel, we've been there. They said there's only one drug these days that sometimes can cure this disease, but the side effects can kill you. And so we talked about everything from the patient's perspective. And it's important also to note that I didn't just take what they said as gospel. I always brought it to Dr. Sands or my oncologist to get a reality check. Mm-hmm. The point here with participatory medicine, the title of the book is Let Patients Help, not Patients Know Everything.
Right, right. What do you think about, first I want to ask you why. Why did you think this was going to help him? But also, I would think that there may be some doctors who might find this a little bit offensive, right? You spent how many years in medical school? I've heard people say, what do you have, Google MD, right? I mean, do you really know everything because you've done a Google search, and there's a lot of misinformation out there. Mm-hmm. So first, let's start with why is an online community beneficial in general?
Well, look, Dave, let me give you a quote, okay? Pierre Lévy, who is a professor at the University of Ottawa, said a number of years ago, and I love this, he said, nobody knows everything. Everybody knows something. All knowledge resides in networks of people. Mm. And what that means to me in this context, he wasn't talking about healthcare, is that Dave may have the best doctors, the best medical team, the best oncology nurses, and so on, but they're not going to know everything. They're going to know everything on the medical side, but they're having not been through this, then it's they don't really know everything. Mm-hmm. And having a network of patients who have been through this, that makes a big difference. They're able to give him a different kind of advice, complementary advice, and that's really where the value of this is.
And so then how do you deal with the misinformation or patients thinking that they absolutely know what to do in it, and you may not feel as a physician that it is the right thing to do? So how do you balance those?
This is a conversation starter, Deborah. This is kind of as Dave said. You know, he didn't take things that he read online and just accept them as gospel. This was a conversation starter. So patients should be engaged in finding that information wherever they're finding it and should bring it to their trusted providers. And we, as doctors and nurses, should welcome them to do that, and we should have a conversation. That's an opportunity to teach.
Mm-hmm. You know, the founder of our movement was a doctor who died a few years ago named Tom Ferguson, who Danny knew, I didn't. And he, at the time of his death, was working on a manifesto funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, where he documented things like there's far too much medical literature for anybody to know everything. So it's perfectly legitimate for patients to go looking for things to supplement what their doctors know. And a modern doctor will welcome it. And if the patient's not good at it, will help them develop their skills.
Do you think that participating in this community and having access to other people's experiences like this helped you beat the disease?
My oncologist says that, believe it or not. And this is, it's funny, I often draw parallels between our movement and the women's movement. One of the founders, one of the editors of the original edition of Our Bodies, Ourselves, said we weren't getting the answers we needed, so we decided to go get them ourselves. In the British Medical Journal, my oncologist, Dr. David McDermott, said, you were really sick, and I don't know if you could have tolerated enough medicine if you hadn't been so prepared. And what he was talking about was, remember, the side effects sometimes kill people? I asked them, how do I prepare? And he said, that's a good question. Nobody's asked us. So I asked the patient community, and I got 16 firsthand stories, and it was the oncologist who says that he believes it helped me survive.
Hmm. Danny, what do we know about any research as to, well, you know, how effective this is? Has anybody studied participatory medicine?
Really? People have been studying for a long time different aspects of participatory medicine. You know, when we think about this, we talk about the use of online patient communities, online patient information. We talk about a collaborative decision-making, shared decision-making. So a lot of these things have been evaluated. And it is we know that patients who are more engaged in their health and partner better with their clinicians do tend to have better outcomes. We're still early. We still need to do lots of research in this space. Huge amount of anecdotal information that this is useful. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's important for listeners to understand one important thing, that just because a patient, just because we talk about being patient-centered doesn't mean the patient is always right in every situation.
Exactly.
So it's not the Sam Walton, Walmart kind of thing where the customer is always right. It is the it's more the Cy Sims model from Sims department stores, which is an educated customer is our best customer. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this partnership is really a magical thing, and it really makes a huge difference in the quality of life for both clinicians and patients.
Do you think that's a do you think most of your colleagues would agree with you? Or do you think you might have to change some doctors' minds?
We have some work ahead of us.
Okay.
It's like every social movement.
It is.
You know,
it is.
I lived through feminism in the 60s and 70s, and it's always the younger people tend to have the new attitude. The more established people tend to have the older attitude.
All
exactly.
Right. All right. Well, Dave DeBroncart and Dr. Danny Sands, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Great to be here, Deborah. Thank you.
Dave and Danny are co-founders of the Society for Participatory Medicine. They're also co-authors of the book Let Patients Help, a Patient Engagement Handbook. For more of the WBUR series, This Moment in Cancer, you can visit our website, wbur.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.